We'll start. Thanks everybody for coming to location one to the open house Wednesday. Tonight is Joe Lucas, who will be giving a talk on called Airspace, and will also be presenting his upcoming book called Ether, the Nothing That Connects Everything. Oh yeah, this is February. They're also at the front, there are coupons for the book, 30% off the book if you
Flyers slash
He is an assistant professor of art at the University of South Carolina and teaches sound art there. And he also has an upcoming hypertext essay on Deleuze called F2F, Creative Urbanism and Dax's Heads.
That's not part of the title, though. That's the description. Right,
okay, but it's about creative urbanism and the backs of heads. And that will launch on November 1st on a new web journal, Hyper
Rise. It's actually kind of supposed to be Deleuzian stuff.
You can ask him afterwards. Yeah, he already tells. And then he also has another meta sci-fi Christmas musical online called Don't Put It On Today.
It's coming this holiday season.
So,
sometimes I have this initial anxiety, and I was talking to Heather about this whenever I give a talk as to whether to go just cool spontaneously without text or with text. And I think tonight it's going to be a mix of an actual address that is coming from text. I might sort of go away from it if that starts to seem boring and I start to glaze over. And the performance, and then sort of like a more free-form description of the book, Ether, the Nothing That Connects Everything. And hopefully then we just can get some lively questions and discussion and things like that. But, you know, sort of talking just off the cuff has always fascinated me. I used to, this might date me a little bit, but I used to love to watch Merv Griffin a lot after school, because it came on right after General Hospital. Sometimes I wouldn't get home in time to see Luke and Laura, that old, you know, the weather machine on the island of Nico's pastime, you sort of remember that. And so I would be sort of start watching Merv Griffin, and I sort of got into it because I was just so amazed how people just so easily talked, and just talked about anything, and sort of chatted, and you know, people like Orson Welles, you know, were on sort of doing sort of weird telepathic trips, and you know, that always was interesting to me. But you know, regarding talk shows, when I got a little bit older and when I started to realize that, you know, people were only on talk shows because if they were intellectuals, they were only on talk shows if they had books out, you know, and you couldn't have like Susan Sontag coming on like you had Zsa-Zsa Gabor coming on Merv, you know. And to me that seemed to be a problem, and I was always annoyed when somebody that I was interested in came on, let's say Letterman, only to push their book. So hopefully today I'm not going to be pushing the book, and I'm going to be talking about things that are actually of interest to me now that might intersect with the book, and definitely towards the end it will be more, you know, sort of following the contours of the book. But at first I'm just going to talk about things that are interesting to me now that are ethereal in nature or have to do with transmission art and this performance. One of the things that has been interesting to me is this summer I has anybody read Deleuze's Difference in Repetition? Just off the... It's very difficult. I put it down so many times in frustration. And I'm not sort of suggesting you read it, although it's sort of very interesting. People kept on saying to me it was the most important Deleuze book. But it's very difficult. And I like difficult reading, and I like Deleuze. And so it's more difficult than most Deleuze. But... you know, two times people said to me, well, you know, the image of thought is really the most important section of that book, and, you know, you really got to read that. So I decided not to be hard on myself and, you know, not feel bad that I couldn't read the whole book, and I sort of went for this chapter or sort of section called The Image of Thought. And so I'm going to talk about this the section, the image of God, and what it could have to say for radio, and how it can be used as an interesting tool. In this section, the image of God, it basically is about how ontology or ontological scenarios found philosophy, the foundational. But in a sense, while they are foundational to philosophy, they unduly limit its future. They sort of are sort of boundary creators in a sense. So if you have Descartes' cogito, I think, therefore I am, that's an example of an image of thought. You know, this is sort of the thing that we think is sort of free discursive to technology. It happens before, not technology, but philosophy. It happens before philosophy starts, this whole idea of I think, therefore I am. But it's based on the assumption that we know exactly what thinking and being is. And these questions of what thinking and being is might be the biggest questions, and they shouldn't be just assumptions or givens that we build philosophy on top of. So you can see how that might close down possibilities, and why Deleuze was interested in going, going for the, what do they call it? Going for the jugular, that's the word. Going for the jugular, sort of going for I think, therefore I am, saying that, you know, this is where the problem is. And for Deleuze, to add insult to injury, ontological truths come with the assurance that philosophy is goodwill, merely because we know what thinking and being is. That thinking and being cannot but be for the good, the love of knowledge, you know, and all that. And Deleuze, you know, doesn't want to have anything to do with that, all that. And in some sense, his critique isn't anything new. It's something that we might be familiar with. It's the critique that both Derrida and Lacan had, that nothing is really before discourse. You know, that these sort of pre-ontological scenarios are constructed. But Deleuze wants to do something about it. He has a kind of project. So what he wants philosophy to be, to put it in a nutshell, is not be goodwill, I think, therefore I am, thus, you know, philosophy must be this love of knowledge thing, everything is good. But he wants philosophy to be ill will, and he wants to destroy the image of thought. Now, he even goes as far as saying he wants to destroy all images of thought, even his own. But later on, he mellows out with his work with Guattari, and he sort of says, well, I do have an image of thought, and it's the plane of immanence. And we'll talk a little bit about the plane of immanence later, because it's an ethereal idea, and so we can get to that. So here's where you got to follow carefully. I mean, I'm not just going off on the news. Here's where the connection comes. What makes radio bad is precisely this image of thought. But we can nuance it to say that what makes big radio bad is the image of radio. And does anybody sort of follow what goes on transom.org and the sort of material they have on there? They have some, you know, very interesting, good resources, interviews, sound documentaries and things like that. Recently, Rick Mooney had an interview basically on these issues of what makes radio bad and what makes radio good. And he was right to say that the problem of radio is humanism, which is the same sort of critiquing ontology. You're also sort of, in a sense, critiquing humanism. And he says the problem with radio is humanism. And what he's talking about is this myth of ontological goodwill, as it affects, shows that even he holds dear, like This American Life and The Next Big Thing and Radio Lab and Their Ilk. So think about, you know, and I'll sort of parse this out later, think about how something we may call ontological goodwill constrains what can go on in those types of shows. But even though Rick Mooney is critiquing humanism and saying that's the problem, he turns around, and one morning I turn on the radio and he's doing this thing called I believe this and I believe that and blah 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 blah. And, you know, it almost seems an absurd caricature of this idea of sort of radiophonic goodwill. And, but it's so earnest, this resurrection of this old clunker from, I don't know, when I Believe was first on, maybe in the 40s or something like that. But If you want to be more specific about it, think about how radio, at least public radio, presents itself that is somehow better than television or film. And don't doubt for a minute when you start to hear absurdities like that, that you basically lost the game. You know, when you sort of start to have to say radio is better than film and television, that's why we must support it, because it's just ontologically better than television and film. That's, you know, complete hogwash. And that's the image of radio at work, really. And you can see how it works for some. If you sort of listen to NPR and you sort of notice a big corporate underwriter that's sort of always being mentioned, do your research, because they probably are doing some very dirty activities and they sort of are advertising on NPR precisely because they sort of want to benefit from this image of radio, this image of goodwill that is accrued to them through advertising on NPR. But also, you know, one of the things that you want to think about in terms of this image of radio is what I call barroom ontology of radio. If anybody's done radio for sort of public radio or sort of, you know, widely distributed alternative radio, you'll find that producers will frequently encourage you, whether you're a box pop on the street or whether you're a colleague that's doing a piece, to act as if you're talking to somebody at a local bar. And this seems to me to be the eternal problem that Americans have with imagining their audiences is somehow not having all their faculties. That somehow audiences are this platonic Joe that you must sort of like somehow speak down to. And, you know, I'm Joe, and I know that you're going to get my attention if you speak. If you're at a bar, you're talking in very unradiogenic sentences and stuttering and trying to sort of explain to me what you think about Elcon Seminar 20. I mean, those are the things that interest me. Those are the things that I might like to hear on radio. You know, unless you have everybody jumping up on the table dancing, that's what's going to get my interest. And I would also ask, you know, how often do public radio producers go to bars? Even though they're sort of, you know, sort of floating this barroom ontology. And even if they do, you can remember Luigi Russolo's complaint about music as sort of just drunkenly sipping from bar to bar. And you can say the same for radio in terms of this. I mean, basically, ontology, when you think about it, and just to be clear, if anybody has read things that I've written, I talk about radio ontology, but that's a different type of ontology because that's in that particular work that you may or may not have read. I'm talking about radio ontology, like people talk about what are the essential qualities of the medium, you know, sort of kind of like David Anton's video as blah, 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 I forget the name of the essay, or Rosalind Krauss's video narcissism. You know, what are the essential qualities of the technology and the art? This is related, but it's a little bit different. It's a sort of philosophical bottom line thinking, which in a day-to-day sense, you hear when a corporation says something like, it's all about you, the people, or it's all about you, the listener, we are like the people, or even things like, it's all about story. And the problem of humanism is that statements like these, which sometimes fantastically cover up systematic ill will, you know, their goodwill that's masking ill will, when they don't actually stop thought, they limit identity, and are a kind of shaming discourse. Like, you must not be human if you don't believe in these things. When in fact, you know, we might all somewhat, you know, believe in these things and have sort of a warm spot in our heart for other people and narrative stories and things like that, but when it's kind of bundled together in this package where you sort of have to sort of like it or lump it, that sort of stops thought. But I think that the most useful way to talk about the image of radio as a kind of image of thought is how we envision or how we don't envision the network. And this image is challenged more often than those above because there's a lot of artists that deal with how the technology is configured and that being part of the art. And it also works with Deleuze's philosophy because Deleuze is interested in interconnections and circuits and configurations and things like that. We can either take for granted the naturalized image of radio as it's received, or we can imagine the network as this open, chaotic assemblage of wires, transmitters, receivers, airspace, a system that we usually take as a given, and we rarely reflect on the oddness of it. We rarely reflect on the fact that, for example, talk radio includes radio, satellite, telephones, faxes, cell phones, and cars, not to mention the internet and even television. So you have a radio show, but it's more than radio. It's this sort of kind of floating network that has become naturalized, and we don't think of the connections anymore. So this naturalization of the image of radio also edits out parts of the network that can't but challenge radio's image of goodwill. So if we think, for example, of radio writers from the last 15 or so years, why were they successful? They were successful because they found out that these edited out features had been so successfully suppressed, repressed, and so basically what was left out of radio and radio history was this whole fertile ground that nobody really had explored because it didn't fit into this image of radio. So, and even today, people that are sort of more traditional radio producers and musicians don't even recognize this kind of other radio that has developed around what has been edited out of the network. So, all the ill will features of radio in the radiophonic system, like war, psychosis, electrocution, fascism, colonization, mind control, aliens, corpses, and ghosts. Well, how did they get there? They were always there. Okay, so that's, so that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with this image and how it keeps these realities out of the mix. Okay. The strategy of people who are doing transmission art is also an interesting way to challenge this image of radio. The artists that are doing transmission art, and hopefully if you didn't get a chance to see all the exhibitions, there's some interesting transmission art in the gallery here, and if you go around the corner, it's a kind of really great thing with twine and sound and little kind of machines, which you should check out before you leave. But artists will expose the oddness of creating networks by creating idiosyncratic networks and inventing new connections. So if we think about it, with transmission art, radio art is not just the creative creation of content, but it's about creative manipulation of the radio system. And, a lot of people here are down with transmission art and just kind of know all about this, so I won't belabor that. Now, usually this work does not get done on public radio because by definition, perhaps, public radio is a system that is already defined, even though you might, add an ISDN link or get a new satellite or hire a plucky new reporter. Those things can happen in the public radio system, but sort of rarely an idiosyncratic configuration will emerge from that. And unfortunately, I think, and this is something we can talk about or debate, there's a strict line between the kind of experiments that get done in transmission art, especially those that are more gallery-centric, and the kind of thing that gets heard widely. But for me, I would like to turn on my radio in Columbia, South Carolina, and I want to hear something other than, sad to say, the only thing that I like to listen to on that radio is sort of echoes with John DiLiberto and the Writer's Almanac at sort of 11 in the morning, and there's really nothing that are else on that system that I regularly listen to, sad as it might seem. One's only a couple minutes a day, and the other might be just a way to self-medicate myself with audio Prozac, but anyway, I want this kind of stuff to be on my radio and not my computer, and that's another thing that we might want to debate, and whether it's a rational choice or not. Because I think that in some sense, the issue is this eternal paradox of noise. If you want to make a kind of art of noise, there has to be some way to make the noise sensible. And I think that there's something about the radio that is just enough, like a kind of container or a frame or whatever, to make noise sensible, compared to the infinity of what could go on behind the computer screen. There's something about the limited range of frequencies that makes that gives an interesting frame to noise with radio. So, with radio, do we really need the clear, concise, common sense use of hosts, DJs, clear talking, concise editing, standardized programming slots? I would say no, because sort of the radio itself is a kind of very interesting interface that does all those things without having those features. Or we can use those elements in radio as kind of ready-mades. So we can forge new combinations and new senses of what a host or a DJ might be. And I think that avant-garde would do well to investigate how strategies for making experimental radio more part of everyday life by sort of using and recombining these forms without falling into the traps of formalized radio or cliches of noise on the other. But I think, and again, many of you might know this work, I think the classic instance of negotiating the everyday, commandeering the network, and challenging its image is still Gregory Whitehead's Pressures of the Unspeakable, where Whitehead poses himself as this doctor of screamology, and he goes on public radio in Australia, and it's kind of, you know, he sort of fools them into setting up shop there, and he takes call-ins, and has a kind of interview slash hoaxes. And what he does is reveals this press screamscape of the radiophonic system. He gets all these people to call in and scream and talk about screams. But there's also, of course, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, which played with the limits of radio programming and its system and its message. As a consequence, it also really changed the radio system completely. I mean, and we should be aware how if we do an experiment, sometimes history changes, and the experiment is no longer valid, or we can't do it again. You know, one thing that happened after Welles' broadcast is everybody was like, you know, if this caused people to react in this way, what would they do if we sort of really used this as a commercial medium? And so, you know, that was the era after that broadcast where sort of commercials became constantly a part of the airtime because people realized how effective radio was. And we can think of commercials as part of this system. Commercials are sending you out into other spaces. It's part of this sort of very strange network of messages and technology. Now, transmission art has really thrived in the last, you know, like half a decade or so because of some of the really great, or more than that, advances, the legal victories that sort of low-power broadcasters won in the late 90s. But, I wonder if this little device here is kind of like a tipping point for transmission art. You know, these little consumer devices that go from iPods to car antennas or radios. You know, it's very interesting because this is something that is consumerably available to consumers. And, you know, you can do your own transmission art at home and just kind of fool around with this and radios and things like that. So it would be interesting to see whether something like this would popularize transmission art or whether or not it would just kind of stay, you know, in more esoteric context. Or maybe just people are just naturally doing transmission art, just like they're kind of naturally making video art with their whatever. Okay. So I'm going to do this performance. And basically, the IROCs are... Did anybody bring their own radios? Got one? You still do, Zoe. Okay, you got one back there? Okay, I'm going to pass out some radios. It's kind of a radiophonic chamber music. And, you know, these things won't really pass that curtain, I found. And now that we have bodies in here, it's going to have trouble penetrating your flesh and your machine parts, you know, pacemakers and medical implants are always a problem. And it's meant to be very intimate. For those of you who I'll hand the radio, you know, if you need to sort of tune in closely, sort of do so. It's kind of nice to listen from the speaker. There's no amplification. And in fact, I had a conversation with a person who's doing a live feed, and we were doing a sound check, and I was like, you know, it's not, you know, it's paradoxical that I'm doing this thing that's intentionally supposed to be intimate, and it's broadcasting, you know, wherever on the web, and I'm sort of like, you know, I really don't want to have to sort of fool around too much trying to get high fidelity with this because it's beside the point. And what I really want this to be is a sort of very sort of localized, intimate performance. And, you know, for those of you at home, you might not be able to hear it. and you just gotta invite me to your place, and I'll come, and we'll do it for you. All right, so let's do this. You know what? I just gave that whole speech without the loud, clear microphone.
Yes.
Is that a problem?
No.
Okay.
Can we put it on for when you talk?
Okay, but I'm not talking now. So where is it? It's here. Okay, fashionable tote bag. Now, when I do, is it all on? Or do I have to flip a switch in here?
You'll need to flip a switch.
Okay, I think I know where it is, even though I didn't really check it out beforehand, but I think I know where it is. All right, so. Zoe, do you want to tune in 88.7? 88.7?
Thank you.
Anybody sort of try to detune the videos? Because I'm open to that, but I never like outright invite it. But I've got an audience to do that sort of fantastically. But I didn't really sort of pay attention. Does anybody go as far as detuning it? Because I can only hear that one. Really. Did it sound okay out there? Did it get to your. Alright. So starting from the idea of radio, I want to talk about the concerns with my book. And I think that whenever I talk about my book, I end up going one rabbit hole or the other, and I end up not talking about my book at all. So the best way to talk about it would be to sort of diagram and schematize that. Oh, yes. Oh, it just stays on here like this. I don't have to clip it on my... Oh, Eric, okay. Okay. All right, so... what I want to do is I want to diagram some illustrations of the history of radiance. And basically what we just saw was this... Kinda. Okay. So here's this sort of radiophonic form of radiance where you have these technologies which are meant for transmitting vibrations. And this idea of vibration and how things are connected to other things and people connected to other people is not merely a product of radio and radio technologies and other 20th century technologies, but goes back to sort of pre-Socratic philosophers and their attempts to figure out exactly sort of how we're connected to the world and sort of what are those ephemeral things that are beyond us that that make us feel vital and alive. There's different within the history before we have the radio universe. We have, we could say that in the pre-Socratic universe, we have this idea of, you know, person, you know, and they're kind of hooked up to the whole thing, you know, and that's sort of how the radiance works there. There is this notion that we are somehow, but there was a point within the history of philosophy where this kind of innate intuitive connection to the universe was sundered by technologies, by things like sort of writing. You know, Socrates and Plato always complained about writing because it sort of broke down this ability for us to sort of connect on these sort of more ethereal planes, and but at the same time, like any technology, like the radio system, we see that even though it separates, it also connects. So it's the paradox of technology. You know, we sort of interpose these machines and words and things like that in between us and other people. And is this something that is challenging our natural radiance and vitality, or is it something that sort of gives us access to more vitality and more radiance? And you know, people like Artaud, you know, think the body itself is a kind of bad technology. You know, sort of in to have done with the judgment of God. He says something like, you know, we must do away with all our automatisms and become bodies without organs, something of that sort. So that the whole idea of the body without organs is ethereal in origin too. It's as if to say, okay, we have this body that's organized in a way for us to pick up certain communications,
But the communications are not the right communications, or they're sort of like kind of piddling communications that we don't need to really pay attention to, that we really want to, you know, be connected to the whole thing and almost destroy ourselves in this ethereal pulsation continuum. And, you know, the futurists want to do that too, and there's sort of fascist connotations to that as well, a kind of body loathing, a kind of, you know, sort of wanting to merge with technological ethers. But I digress. Let's go on to sort of other diagrams. So then you have, throughout, you know, from the pre-Socratics through classical philosophy, then to the rediscovery of classical philosophy in medieval and Renaissance eras, you have, basically, what starts to become dominant before the Renaissance is this idea, which is more Aristotelian, although, you know, the sort of general shorthand for talking about the difference between Plato and Aristotle is kind of what I'm going to talk about. But if you sort of actually read these guys, it's all going on in every, you know, it's more having to do with this system of interpretation of their texts. And they're not, I'm going to caricature them, but it's not really that cut and dry. But nevertheless, the Aristotelian interpretation of ethers and absolutes has to do with the fact that, you know, here is humanity, and here are these kind of absolute ethers, and you are just kind of down here, and they are up there, and there is no connection whatsoever. And that sort of was very influential for a certain kind of Christianity, a certain kind of, you know, the abjection of early mystics, where they're sort of like, I cannot know, and even if you do, you know, like in the cloud of unknowing, where sort of God is behind these clouds, and you can't, well, not clouds, but you're just beyond. You can't know anything about God, and even if you sort of do get these signs and signals, you go, watch out, because it might be the devil, you know, if you sort of get these sort of lights and funny sort of feelings inside, you know, because you're not supposed to be connected up to it. Okay, and that's where, you know, sort of radical people like Giordano Bruno in the Renaissance period, you know, basically they were whittling away at this system and bringing back this idea that, no, humans are connected to the whole thing, and we're not in this ladder, this cosmic sort of chain, this hierarchy that goes from, you know, the snails down to the Godhead, but that somehow it was all in this system of vibrations and interconnections, and that really had very crucial things to do with how knowledge was formed. And if anybody has read like Foucault's The Order of Things, it's basically what it's all about. How do these epistemologies of ordering the universe, which is basically what cosmology is, how does cosmology affect how we think about systems of thought? And, you know, there was a break at, well, okay, I'm not going to digress there. That's another rabbit hole. Let's just go back to the diagrams. Okay, so this is sort of medieval, and then there's Renaissance, which is a rediscovery of this kind of Platonic, you know, vibrations everywhere. So let's go to the scientific period, which is actually where my book kind of starts, even though I go back to these things. Okay, the ether was something that for natural philosophers in pre-Socratic times was something that, okay, it came down to, okay, how do we break up these elements of our world? So there is air, fire, earth, water. Well, which one of those is the most important one? Which one of those interpenetrates all of them? And so, you know, some people like Heraclitus thought it was fire, and fire was actually in everything and empowering the vital forces that make us sort of lively. And then at one point it was pneuma, this idea of the breath that is in everybody, and that we sort of know, you know, sort of spiritus, the root of spirituality means breath in Latin, and so that's kind of what became dominant, this idea that air and breath was the prime element, the element that kind of moved everything. Well, you know, philosophers tend to make things, they like to make things more complicated than they actually are, and that's the fun of philosophy. And sometimes they can get to even greater truths by making them complicated. I'm not sort of, you know, trying to be anti-intellectual here. But what was I saying? Okay, so they were complicating. So basically, this idea of air, people were like, well, there's air, and then there's another air, you know, which is kind of like air, you know, they spell it, which is kind of, and air like this, which was related to, and I forget the exact etymology, but, you know, the kind of words broke up, and then all of a sudden, you know, air had this uncanny double that was kind of floating beyond air. And, you know, for some it was the fifth element, that's what Aristotle called it. And in fact, the Bruce Willis movie, which I write about a little bit, is actually about the ether, if you sort of go see it. You know, sort of the supermodel Mila Jovovich has this sort of, remember at the end, she has this heart chakra blast that saves the world, and it's all about these sort of theosophical organizations of ether. Anyway, so where was I? Okay, so there is this sense that people were trying to just parse out what the elements were. And where was I going with that? Okay, so basically, when we get to 300 years ago, and so basically this ether then becomes very tied up in all these philosophical debates and how many crystalline spheres gird the universe and what angels are where and how does the book of nature resemble the sort of book of the universe and all those kind of questions. Then, about 300 years ago, people were like, well, you know, the ether, they came together with the first scientific paradigm. The very first was to sort of say, okay, what can we sort of make as the global consensus for the science of electricity? What can we all agree on so we don't have to go back and reinvent the wheel? Because as, you know, many of you probably know, science in the medieval period, if you had like a little discovery, like you sort of discovered that the planets moved in elliptical orbits, you had to create your own cosmos to make it all work, you know. And so every time somebody came up with a discovery, they had to sort of show how it connected to everything else. And so everybody had to reinvent the wheel every time they had an interesting discovery. And it was very convoluted and very interesting and had all this sort of mystical arcana in involved. And people were very polymathic as a result. But in the days of electrical science, you had people said, okay, we need to have this global consensus. And so they decided on the ether as something we can all agree on in which electricity acts and travels. So people like Ben Franklin were involved with that and Isaac Newton. Even though they remained, like for example, Newton was kind of a closet alchemist and he had connections to these sort of weird mystical origins, even though he's seen as the founder of pragmatic modern science. And it's precisely because of the fact that this term, ether, had this history where all these sort of, you know, interesting supernatural things were going on in it. But they were trying to make it a term of science. So we get, at one point, in the work of Anton Mesmer, you know, who had these salons, he was somebody who was this renegade guy during the French Revolution and after, who came up with this notion of healing based on something called the fluidum, in which we're all bathed in this ethereal fluid. And so we're connected to the stars by means of this sort of medium. We're connected to each other. So, for example, if I can sort of somehow harness those powers, I can sort of somehow through my animal magnetism, and this is where the term animal magnetism comes from, through my animal magnetism, I can control the ethers, and I can somehow heal you if I wanted to. And so here's the system. The mesmeric system is this idea that yes, there is. I mean, it's really, you know, back to this pre-Socratic notion, and it's the idea that we are connected to these cosmic ethers, and we can use them for medical purposes and things like that. And there's a whole bunch of stuff in Mesmer. About Mesmer that I'm not going to go into, but nevertheless, Mesmer's ideas, you know, come up in the work of Poe. There's a lot of Poe in the book. They emerge in 19th century theosophy, sort of the clash or the interpenetration of yogic science, theosophy, and industrialism in the 19th century is a very interesting melange of influences, and that's where you get, you know, in that time you get things like the science of auras, where theosophists are saying, well, you know, auras are actually not not just a supernatural thing, but now that we're discovering these new things because of the science of electromagnetism, we're discovering all these immaterial waves, we can say that all these things that used to be fantasy are actually for real. You know, and so there's this kind of rapprochement between spiritualism and science at this period. Whereas, you know, 20 years before that period, there was, it was more like spiritualism was caught in these more sentimental, movements, and theosophy tried to kind of move away from the sentimentalism of spiritualism and, you know, make some kind of alliances with science. You have Henri Bergson at the time, some talk about him as well, and what have you. But the interesting thing is that at the end of the 19th century, the ether was debunked by experiment done by Michelson and Morley, and they were trying to figure out basically they were looking for what the speed of the earth in the ether wind was, or something to that effect. Details are foggy right now. But the fact was that what they sought out to do, they sought out to do something, and what they actually found out, which was the unplanned result, was that there was no ether wind. There was no kind of the planet did not experience any kind of resistance as it was going through the ether wind, because their data should have been one way if it was going one way and one way if it's going the other, and it wasn't. So I'm not a scientist, so I can't really explain it off the cuff. But anyway, they were sort of like, well, there is no ether. And so during that period, we have a lot of these cosmologies that are brought in to fill the gap. You know, well, what do we replace the ether with? It's been the placeholder for the absolute, and for a while it was a placeholder for our ideas of God, and then it became a placeholder for science. Now that it's gone, what do we do? And so that was a really interesting period of all these kind of homemade cosmologies that were coming into being. And of course, the person who replaced the ether was Einstein. I mean, the idea of space-time was basically the replacement for the ether. So that's part of the history. But as the ether was becoming debunked, at the very same time, the science of electromagnetism was taking off, and through the technology of radio, people were starting to use the term ether again, even as it was becoming obsolete. So through radio, ether had this other heyday. And so we're back to the guy or the gal with the radio and the antenna. Okay? And so the question is, and there's a lot of artists who have dealt with and do deal with this idea of this interpenetration of technology and spiritualism. The big question is, well, when we're in this system, is this system a possibility for this, you know, or is it like the example of this? And if you can see this, all the waves are going away, and you have this alienated body without aura, without just the sort of like this material sort of nothing, kind of even worse than here, because we don't even have this to guarantee stuff. So what is it? You know, sort of what is? And again, this is a question that goes back to Plato, because it has to do with just language itself. If we interpose language in between us and the universe, does it give us a better connection to things, or does it somehow possibly disconnect us from the world? I mean, it might be both. But the thing is that dialectic between, say, rationality and the sort of irrationality, or sort of somehow interconnection and separation, is going on throughout history. And that's, you know, pretty much what I talk about. But I did say before I go on that I wanted to say something about the plane of immanence. And I just wanted to say, because, again, it's an interesting thing that I've been just thinking about lately, so I just want to share it with you. The plane of immanence is interesting because it's kind of like the ether, but with a crucial difference. And if we think about a system like this, you know, when people say God is immanent in all things, well, it's definitely not this, because here God is just beyond us. We can't even think about it, but it sort of actually determines everything in the universe. Here, if we say God is immanent of all things, we're kind of still stuck with this idea, even though we imagine that divinity is everywhere in this kind of Platonic animism. There's still this idea that one term guarantees everything. You know, so it's kind of like Zeus, who had to stick his dick everywhere, right? That's what God immanent in all things is, basically. So what Deleuze is saying is that immanence has no guarantor. It has no prime term. It's like everything is immanent in everything else. And that's why you have these becomings in Deleuze, is because things become other things because of the connections that are there. And you can even say, you know, wrap your brain around this one, that even immanence is immanent to itself. Okay, and Deleuze says that, you know. Sputter, sputter, you know. It's a hard one to think about. I think I had some other things that I want to say, but I feel like I've set the stage, and maybe we could have discussion. Yes?
The Mesmer diagram that you have?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Is the Mesmer one able to control the environment and the waves as opposed to pre-Socratic where they just act on you?
Yes. And that was the problem because sort of Mesmer, had this, he was very charismatic. He would wear these purple robes and he'd have these salons and he'd have these glass harmonicas and he'd have all these sort of impressionable aristocratic women who would come. And so people were like, oh my God, you know, basically he's going, there was all these, claims of sexual misdoings. And so it was this idea that somebody would have a strong reserve of animal magnetism could control the waves more than other people's with less animal magnetism. So it became this sexual thing. And even if you see Fellini films, which I talk about because there's a lot of mesmeric hypnotist characters, there's that scene in 8 1/2 where they go to the nightclub and the guy is reading people's minds. And he goes up to one of the guests at the nightclub and she says, you know, no, stop it, you're crucifying me, stop it. And it seems like it kind of is framed as a kind of sexual harassment type thing. What's that? It's the Asanisi Masa scene, exactly. But the hypnotists are undeniably sweet in Fellini's works, like in Knights of Cabiria, there's a hypnotist scene. But there is this undercurrent, that there's a little bit of creepy aspect to them. And I think what Fellini's doing is he's saying, he uses that as a allegory for his relationship to the cinema because, as you probably know, you know, sort of Fellini was in some sense, later in his career reacting to neorealism, reacting to the kind of purity of sort of, you know, okay, we have to film the realistic life and sort of realistic things in realistic ways, you know, to sort of just gloss that quickly. But, you know, Fellini was like, well, no, you know, if you actually want to be realistic, you want to include the fantasy stuff. And so, and that's basically kind of what Deleuze is doing, too. He's saying, well, my empiricism is a superior empiricism because it's taking into account all these fantastic immaterialities. And it's sort of both mystical and materialist, even though kind of you see within the factions of Deleuze philosophers, you have like people like Jonathan Rachman, and they're all good scholars, people like Jonathan Rachman who interprets Deleuze as this 80s postmodern materialist, and you have people like James Chandler who is interpreting him as a kind of sort of Platonic medieval sort of guy doing these mystical things, and it's kind of both. But my point was, okay, so Fellini is sort of saying, okay, sort of fantasy is kind of part of reality, and the hypnotist character is a symbol for the powers of cinema. That you go to the cinema and you want to be mesmerically transformed. You want to sort of fall into the ethers of the cinematic experience. And but it's an ambivalent character because, of course, hypnotism is precisely the way in which fascist power was described in Italy. You know, people recalled living under the fascist regime in Italy as if they were under a trance. And so there's this idea that, and in the 30s, cinema in Italy was seen as something that was making people unable to deal with the material situations at hand and able to be politically conscious. So there's this ambivalence. You know, do we embrace the spectacle and its mesmeric powers, or do we sort of, you know, just have, can we, is it possible by using the cinema to just be purely materialist? You know, a lot of people, like, for example, you know, we can think about 70s and 80s materialist cinema. And that was a paradox they were always engaging in. How can you do cinema without the imaginary? Tony?
Mm-hmm. You're sort of talking about mesmerism as kind of pre-electronic internet sex. But each new technology, as it comes up, offers, often the ability to speak to the dead.
Uh-huh.
And also, anxieties about it consuming or taking over the individual's will. It was true, television.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the rhetorics that have to do with the main kind of pitch around the technology being the thing that's actually lost, like telephones reach out and touch someone, or virtual reality is really being there.
Those
things that in fact are really the thing in fact that is gone.
It's almost silly how history keeps on repeating this way. And you see, for example, people like in the 90s, you have the guy who was the chief engineer of Iridium on the front page of the Wall Street Journal saying that Iridium is God speaking through us. A1 on the Wall Street Journal. And I had a little bit of a email sort of correspondence with him, and he really believed that. Interesting thing about Iridium, though, for those of you who follow these things, was that, Iridium was this, 66 satellites in low Earth orbit, and it was supposed to have this sort of ubiquitous telephone system. Nobody really bought into it. It was sort of too expensive, and it failed. But then a couple years later, some investor bought it for pennies on the dollar, and put it back together, and now it's like the biggest beneficiary of this current war. And the Bin Ladens have a major, major investment in Iridium. So one wonders as to these connections between, it's very interesting, Yes.
Just another thing to add to this mesmeric thing, because I think it's often thought of the magnetic operator influencing somebody else, but there was another very interesting strain of mesmerism that was pioneered by somebody shortly after mesmerism called, I can't pronounce it wrong, the Marquis de Puysinger, a French nobleman, and his idea of the ether, it was a much more a substance in the world. People went into trances by tying themselves to trees.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I've heard this, yeah, yeah.
But what was really interesting was that you didn't go have a kind of orgasm, but you became more, smarter. You'd have these presence, and they could discourse with savants. That you became, something was allowed, instead of being influenced by somebody else, something came out of you to transform you. And people would diagnose their illnesses and predict the date of their cure.
Huh, interesting.
They healed themselves rather than being manipulated by somebody else.
Correspondence courses. that seems to be very similar to the idea of the noosphere, which is kind of like this sort of mesmeric vibrational system, but it has to do with, it kind of intersects more with artificial intelligence and thought about artificial intelligence, that there is this sphere of thought that we're all connected up in, and this is important for a lot of 60s filmmakers who were dealing with these ideas and thinking
about the internet.
Yeah, and it got rediscovered in the 90s. Because it sort of was something that one could think about. You give up. It's kind of an interesting thing because you're able to give up intention and sort of give up to this intelligence that's beyond your intelligence. But it's very similar to like Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. It's sort of like, well, the economy is moved by this sort of ghostly force that we don't have any control over, and it just, whatever happens, happens, and there's this kind of laissez-faire aspect that undergirds the noosphere. But what I'm interested in also is, you know, I think that they are powerful ideas. So there's ways in which, internet capitalists would use these ideas in a perhaps cynical way, but there's actually some people who believe that that these things did have transformative powers, and that that the internet does, like say the moonshot did in the late 60s, increase our global intelligence incrementally because we're all experiencing these things together, and we're sort of getting to that sort of video, what sort of Gene Youngbloods calls the sort of video third eye, and you know, stuff like that. You know, that's kind of, it's...
It leads into the sort of homogeneous notion of power, which, tends to kind of revert to the dominant ideology. The idea that we're all connected in this, like, one kind of, homogeneous... Usually means that, there's a
Well, or also when, in fact, like, corporations are fighting for who controls the network, and these are sort of like these idiosyncratic connections that were connected up. They're not these sort of global things which keeps everybody in the loop, but they're like, you know, AOL, Time Warner, sort of like, this is their network, and this is...
The kind of dark sides of the
situation. Yeah. Yeah. Gus?
About what bugs me about internet radio as opposed and broadcasting as opposed to analog or old style broadcasting is that, like, when I was younger, I used to have trouble sleeping. I would turn on the radio and get this really comforting sense that there was somebody else awake. Whereas when you tune into, like, your so much of the digital internet discourse seems to insist on the value, comfort, liberation of this notion of choice. You always have your own choice. You always get exactly what you want. It's the same thing with you used to have like one movie on late at night. You have to watch it. It's a really weird thing you never watch.
So
it seems like there's something different in the way that people talk about the internet, not in terms of things like that being control, but in terms of having control, or the revenge against all the technologies. But I don't know if that's...
It's very interesting. I mean, two things I remember. I remember, when Sunday, the only thing that you could watch was Davy and Goliath. And that was very, very, Sundays were very depressing. From like 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., there was nothing on. And, that certainly has changed. But also, I remember the first time I tuned into internet radio, I was like, oh, I'm going to listen to a station in Brazil. And I tuned into a station in Brazil and it was Prince singing Purple Rain, and it took a while before I found something that was Brazilian, and it turned out to be a Brazilian kind of blues song, which was, also ironic because it was a blues, but at least they were singing in Brazilian, Portuguese. But I really think it's important, that idea of having a radio and tuning in, and it's just, there's the ease of tuning in, scanner. The DJ who works with police scanners and different types of machines that capture signals in the air, he said something that, what you lose with internet radio is that sense of magical reception. There's something magical about tuning into the radio that that you don't get with the internet. And it's precisely because of the fact that you are, you know, you're listening, you're not only listening with other people, and there's sort of, you know, you might listen to something that you might not listen to, whereas in the internet you have to direct yourself towards what you want, which is always, you know, I mean, people have philosophized out, what do you want? You know, that's the big question, right? That's do we really know what we want? Maybe not. But what was my point? Oh yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. You can have receptions or suddenly get shitty and be kind of in this weird place where you kind of were angry to something and then you're not. And
yeah.
You didn't have it or you don't.
Yeah.
And I really love the experience as a kid of kind of tuning something and then finding that I was kind of losing it for no apparent
reason. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the sense of space when you're sort of driving and then you sort of lose it and you sort of drive towards it and yeah. Yes. Yeah. Which is, you know, which is ethereal in a strict sense, because a lot of that scratchiness is basically the sound of the cosmos being picked up by these devices. You know, you were going to ask questions.
Well, that's one thing we were talking about, sort of, you know, what is radio like? And when I was listening to your performance, I was thinking about why it is that there are certain things that in an artistic sound project, generally you can either have fuzz, mm-hmm. A distorted voice, mm-hmm. or lots of echo. Mm-hmm. And all these things trade on some kind of an interference. But it's a transmissive interference. It's something that both distances you from the sound source, but also allows you to trust it somehow, where it makes you feel like somehow this is more... I mean, I'm just sort of speaking off this... This is not a pre-prepared thought. This is just something, as I was listening to your performance, I was thinking about why is it that this is what I get, like when I go to hear sound art, or when I go to hear like a live performance, it's going to be like really artistic, it's going to be digital delay, right?
Uh-huh.
On it, so it's just like, whoa, 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 right?